We good? Excellent. All right. Good. Wow, that's loud. Sorry, everybody. It's good to have everybody here after lunch. I'd hate to be the last person before lunch when you're all hungry and ready to go. I promise I won't be. I won't put you in a food coma. But as Dr. Means mentioned, I am a huge advocate of the beef industry. I grew up. One of the things that people know about me is I ran 52 marathons in 52 weekends. When people hear about that, they automatically assume that I've been running my entire life, which couldn't be further from the truth. I actually grew up a swimmer in northwestern Pennsylvania. Swimming was the sport that I was best at. Grew up in a small town called Titusville. It's known for two things. It's the birthplace of the oil industry. First working oil well was in Titusville, Pennsylvania. And it's also where the Heisman Trophy is from. When I was living there, small town, when you got a varsity letter in a sport, you weren't excited about the varsity letter as much as you were about this extraordinarily ugly brown corduroy baseball cap that you could get at the local general store that would say Titusville Rockets, and then you would get embroidered underneath that whatever sport it was that you got your varsity letter in. So when I got my swimming varsity letter, I asked my mother to go down there and get me one of these hats. She brought it home, and I unwrapped it and it was on the table, and it said Titusville Rockets, track and field. And I was like, Mom, you got the wrong hat. She's like, oh, I just reached into the bin. I just thought they were all swimming or something like that. She's like, I guess I go all the way back downtown and return it. Let me find the receipt. And she was giving me this guilt trip, which I think is funny because back downtown was like about a half of a mile away. But as mothers are wont to do, she made me feel bad enough. I said, no, keep the hat. I'll run track. So that's why I started running. It's because my mother bought the wrong hat. Started running a little bit. I was an 800-meter guy, a half-miler guy. That was the type of event that I thought was way longer than anyone should ever have to run. The guys who ran further distances I thought were insane. I was a cog in the machine on my high school track team. We were absolutely phenomenal. We went 10-0 my senior year. And I say this not as like an arrogance. Like, I saw myself as an outsider looking in. On any given day, I was, at best, the fourth best on our team in any events that I was trying. So I looked at us, and I was like, wow, we were really good. In Pennsylvania track meets, in a dual meet between two schools, there's 150 total points that can be scored in a meet. Our closest meet my senior year was against our arch rival, and that was 101-49. We basically obliterated everybody. But when high school ended, I figured that was when running would end. I was like, that's all I wanted to do. Was to move on and play sports at the collegiate level. The only thing I ever wanted to do was to play football. Even though I was a swimmer growing up, football was my favorite sport. So 3 days before college, before I was trying to walk onto the college football team, I shattered my collarbone playing backyard football. Well, this put on hold 2 years trying to try out for the team. Finally got in shape enough again, went out, tried out for the team. I made it to the final cut of the walk-on cut tryouts before I got cut. The rugby coach for the college had wisely positioned himself outside of the football tryouts. So as we dejectedly walked by him, he asked us if we wanted to try out for rugby. It could have been badminton. I said, I'm sure I would have said yes. If I had known that rugby was football without pads, I'm not sure I would have ever thought about playing. But just like my high school track team, the rugby coach at my college was second in the nation both years that I played. And just like in high school, I was just a cog in the machine. I was a B-squad player at best, which is kind of like second string. When college ended, I thought, okay, sports is over. You know, there's nothing else to do. I'm not getting paid to sport. You know, there's no exercise that is not coming from just manual hard labor. Sports are done. There's no reason to do any more sports. Put on a little bit of weight. Some of the weight that I'd put on in college and bulked up. When I was playing rugby, I was the same height as I am now, but I weighed about 215. Well, some of that weight went to fat, and wasn't a fan of that, but whatever, you know, I was in grad school now, and that's what happens. Decided to lose a little bit of the weight, though, and I thought, what's the best way that I know how to do that? And swimming was it. The problem was trying to find a pool that fit into my schedule that was open when I could is one of the most difficult things in the world, and even if it's open, usually there's people in there, and they get in your way. So I'm like, well, what am I going to do? How am I going to get into shape? And just then, a really cute girl from one of my law school classes went running by. And I was like, well, there's an idea. You know, I'll ask her out and we'll go for a run on a date. And it'll be like, it's not even like I'm asking her out. You know, I just wanted to exercise. So I asked her the next day in class, criminal law. I said, Christy, I saw you running the other day. You want to go for a run this weekend? She's like, yeah, absolutely. Saturday morning sound good? I'm like, perfect. That sounds wonderful. So like 10 o'clock or so, she's like, no, I was thinking like 6 o'clock. I was like, who gets up at 6 o'clock on a Saturday? It's like our only day off. What are you thinking? I think I finally got her to like 7:30 or something like that. I'm a renowned night owl. That was just a horrible hour to get up. Well, we did something like a 6-mile run. I hadn't run 6 miles straight, I don't think ever. Maybe once in track in high school, but I don't think so. And it almost killed me. I didn't realize that Christy had qualified and was training for the Boston Marathon. My first training partner is this pretty darn good runner. So we started running a little bit more and more. I learned a little bit about running, and we're going to go do my first double-digit mile run. I was really excited about it. She's like, I got a course all planned out for you. We're going to go do this course. I was like, all right, 10 miles. This is going to be amazing. She's like, I'll pick you up. And I was confused because we always just met at her house and went for a run. Well, I hopped in the car, and she threw a bib number in my lap. And I said, what's this? And she's like, oh, we're doing a half marathon today. I was like, we're doing a what? When? She's like, if you can do 10 miles, you can do 13. I guarantee it. Just stay with me. We'll run the same pace, and then I'll let you go if you're able to go. Well, she was right. I actually had a really nice run. I ran a 1:39 half marathon for my first time, which is right around an 8-minute mile, give or take. I was very pleased. I thought, this is great. I'm actually a runner now. We started training a little bit more. We became the best of friends. Never even thought about going on a date. She became like a sister to me. And over the next year or so, I was stuck around that half marathon distance. Started doing some longer training runs with her, and I thought, you know what? If I'm going to do these long runs with you, I might as well bite the bullet and run one of those marathon things. So I signed up for it. The longest run I had ever done was 16 miles. For anyone who is a runner here, that's ridiculous to think that I could run a marathon with only one 16-mile training run. It was hubris from youth thinking, oh, I was an athlete in college. I can do this. This shouldn't be a problem at all. So I went into the marathon very virginal in my mind. I had no idea what type of running speed I should do or what my goal should even be. I knew the world record was a 2:05. So I thought, well, you know what? I'll run right around 3 hours. That should be a piece of cake. I mean, who can't run under 3 hours, a full hour slower than the world record? The answer is most people, okay? I didn't know that at the time. In fact, if you break 3 hours in a marathon these days, you're in the top about 2,000 people in North America. But I didn't know that. But I had heard that you're supposed to run as close to even splits as possible throughout the race and keep the same speed, keep up the same pace. So I went out, I ran the first half right around 1:29, perfect pace for this sub-3-hour marathon, and I felt fantastic. I mean, it was 10 minutes faster than I had run a half marathon alone. I'm getting these delusions of grandeur. I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to be on the cover of Sports Illustrated. There's going to be a child prodigy. I'm like, you know what? I hear that you can negative split too if you run the first half within yourself, and I felt completely like that I had done that. I thought, this isn't going to be a problem at all. I said, what would be a great time for a first marathon? If I run a 1:20 for the second half, I'll run a 2:49. I'll be in the 2:40s for my first marathon. This would be fantastic. I ended up running a 2:43 for the second half. Yeah, it was a bad, bad second half, okay? Body fell apart around mile 20. To this day, my most embarrassing moment in my entire running history happened around mile 22. There was an aid station from me to the doors. I could see the people handing the cups. A guy ran by me with one of those fuel belts on, those little Batman-looking belts with all the drinks and stuff, and I begged him for a drink off of his fuel belt. He turned around and he looked at me, looked me up and down, and I must have looked like death warmed over because he unhooked the belt and he handed me the whole thing and said, take it. Son, you need it more than I do, is what he said. I wasn't humble. I wrapped that puppy around my waist. That was now my belt. I could barely finish the race. Found the guy. Actually, he didn't finish too far in front of me, and I gave it back to him. And I told this story 1,000 times. I'm hoping he's in the audience someday because I owe him a new fuel belt because I had no qualms about putting my lips all over that thing. I was dying. I was just sucking, trying to get as much life as possible. Well, I finished that race, and as most marathoners will say, they say they'll never do one again. And I honestly believed that I never would. Called my parents to tell them that I had finished, found out that my grandmother had passed away during the middle of the night. I was like, this is the worst day ever. I mean, I'm going to always associate horrible things with running. And for the most part, the next 2 years, I kind of gave up running. I was running maybe once or twice a week, 2 to 3 miles, just kind of finishing up law school, got a job working for a judge in Erie, Pennsylvania. And I just wanted to, you know, I was happy that I was kind of fit. I had that marathon checked off my list. Well, my judge Googled my name, looking me up for research purposes, and saw my Harrisburg Marathon result. Well, he was an accomplished triathlete. And so he said, you know what, Dane, I think I'm going to be running the Erie Marathon here in about 6 months. I think you should train and run it with me. I said, Your Honor, I really appreciate that offer, but I've done my marathon, thank you. And he's like, no, we're going to train together. And when he said stuff like that, it was like, you're going to do this or you're fired. So I guess I was going to be training with my judge. Well, we started doing a couple of runs together. Then he found out that he wasn't going to be able to make the marathon. And he pulled out after I had signed up. Well, I'm a broke post-law school graduate. I don't waste $80 ever. So I'm like, well, I guess I'm going to run this marathon. Well, I went in there with the same goal, trying to break, 3 hours again. But I ran a little bit more smart. I ran a 1:29 for the first half, right on the average again. And then I ran 2 hours for the second half. 45-minute personal best. Not what I was hoping for, but it was fine. Didn't give up running this time. I thought, okay, well, we'll stick with this. I got a job in Washington, D.C., moved down there because I was starting the interview process to be in the CIA, which is why I laugh whenever people ask me about what my 5-year plans are, because 5 years ago I was interviewing for the CIA. Now I'm standing here in front of you talking about beef and running. So it's never know what's going to happen. But moved down there, got caught up in the Marine Corps marathon hoopla. Decided to sign up, raise some money for charity, and run another marathon. But I said, I'm going to do this one right. I'm going to become a real runner. I'm going to do the training workouts. I'm going to do the hard runs, the fartlek workouts, which is a Swedish word for speed play. And then I knew I was a real runner because I was no longer giggling at the word fartlek. Okay, that's how I knew I had really made the turn. I was doing these long, disgusting 22-mile humid runs in the middle of D.C.'s disgusting humid summers. And I thought, you know what? I am ready for this race. I'm going to get that sub-3. I ran a 1:29 for the first half and then a 2:01 for the second half. I actually got slower than my previous marathon. And I said, you know what? Maybe this marathon thing isn't for me. The half seemed to be okay. Maybe I should do that. And I might not have run another one again, except for I was inexplicably signed up for another marathon 3 weeks later. I don't remember signing up for it. I just remember being signed up for it. And I don't know why I thought I could do 2 marathons 21 days apart. But I was like, well, you know what? Again, don't have a lot of money in the pocket. One of the things that really definitely keeps me going forward is money spent. I tell people all the time, you want to run a race? Pay for it. You will show up, I guarantee you. This race in Maryland was the antithesis of the Marine Corps Marathon. The Marine Corps Marathon has about 500,000 spectators out there cheering you on, giving you unbelievable energy from all the throngs of people giving you cheers. This marathon in Maryland had about 19 people cheering you on. It was in the middle of nowhere, out in the woods. There were more deer than there were people cheering you on. The race was freezing cold. It was about 31 degrees, which I thought was a horrible temperature. It was hilly. It was challenging. There was black ice on the trail. You couldn't really run hard because you'd be slipping and sliding. Everything pointed to this being atrocious, negating the fact that I'd already just run a marathon 3 weeks prior. Came into that race, 3:29 was the best I had ever run in a marathon. I ran a 3:19 that day. Ran 10 minutes faster than I'd ever run. I was like, well, that makes no sense. I must have cut the race short or something, cut off a mile here or there. That's the only way I could possibly have done that. I was like, well, let's sign up for another marathon. A friend of mine was doing her first in Phoenix in 6 weeks, a friend of mine from high school, and she said, if you ever make it to Phoenix, let's go for a run. I said, well, might as well come out to Phoenix. So I went out there, ran the Phoenix Marathon, no expectations, dropped 10 more minutes off my time, qualified for Boston. Ran a 3:09. I was like, huh, all right, well, this doesn't seem right. Let's try for another one. Signed up for another marathon in Tampa, Florida. Wanted to visit my brother. It was a great way to see the country, I thought. He kind of convinced me that there was this event that might be better for me because he was kind of worried that I was doing more marathons than I should because he hadn't heard of anybody doing this many, which is kind of funny now, but I'll get to that in a second. He said, do this race they have instead. It's called the PT Cruiser Challenge. What it is the sponsor's PT Cruiser, but the challenge is on Saturday, you run a 15K or a 9.3-mile race at 7:30 in the morning, 2 hours later, you do a 5K sprint, and then the next day you run a marathon, and they combined all the times, and the person who has the lowest combined time is the winner. And for some reason, that seemed to make more sense than just running a marathon to me. I have no idea why, but I was like, yeah, sure, of course, that makes it. I'll go easy on the third day. That'll be a piece of cake. Well, I went out on day one when you're supposed to go easy and ran both a personal best in the 15K and then the 5K 2 hours later. And I said, this is going to be horrible for tomorrow. Ran the marathon in 3:10. I missed my personal best in the marathon by 30 seconds the day after running two other hard races. Now, this is where the light bulb went off. And I said, you know what? That child prodigy thing that I thought was going to happen during my first marathon obviously isn't going to happen. But for some reason, I do really well when I don't rest a lot. Basically, the anti what everyone tells you to do. So I signed up for 4 marathons in the next 47 days. And I ran faster in every single one of them. Now, I don't know where the idea exactly came to run 52 marathons in 52 weekends. I just all of a sudden was starting to plan it. And I'm glad I didn't know then what I know now about running, because I probably never would have attempted it. There was no reason for me to think that I could do this, not only physically, but logistically. I decided to run these 52 marathons while working a full-time job in D.C. at a patent licensing firm, raising money for charity on the side, thinking it was completely possible for me to do this. And I'm glad that I had that ignorance, because I went in there, and I completed it. That's why I'm here today. And there are a couple of marathons that stand out. I mean, they all have a special memory to me in one way or the other, whether it's good or bad. But there's a couple that are really special. The very first of the year was in Walt Disney. And my father, growing up, right before I was born, my father was crippled in a hunting accident. My entire life, I had never so much as played catch with my dad. But he was a gruff man, but he was always supportive of all the things that I did, even if he didn't fully understand them. So when I was running this marathon, I said I was going to take my cell phone with me. And right before I got to the finish line, I was going to call him so that I could kind of be on the phone with him and he could finish the first race for me. And I think my dad heard that. He's like, whatever, my schmaltzy romantic son. I don't care about that. That's fine. That sounds great. So I called him as I was finishing the first race. He picked up the phone and I was like, Dad, he's like, hello. I was like, it's Dane. I'm about to finish the first marathon. The first what? I'm like, the first marathon, you know, with that gigantic endeavor that I'm undertaking right now. I'm doing this while I'm running, by the way, talking to my father. And he's like, yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. So are you done? I'm like, no, I told you that. Remember how I said we were going to call and you could be with me symbolically because you couldn't be with me during the race. And that's how much I love you. And long pause. And he's like, you get the weirdness from your mother's side, don't you? Click. Thanks, Dad. I hear later he was proud as could be when he got off the phone. But with me, it was always, he kind of kept me in check. And it always takes me back to the day where there was an evening I broke 3 high school records in a swim meet. You can swim in 4 events in one night. And then 3 of them, I broke high school records. I got home. My dad, who had listened to it on the radio, said, what happened in that 4th race? You know, tough love, but I liked it. The 26th marathon of the year was really a milestone as well. When I went into this year, I didn't know a lot about running, but I started to learn a lot. And I realized that people had done similar things to what I was accomplishing, but no one had gone out there and really tried to run as hard as they possibly could every weekend. In hindsight, relatively speaking, finishing a marathon every weekend is not all that hard. Running hard every weekend is. And that was my goal, was I didn't want to just complete these marathons. I had completed a number of them by now. I wanted to compete in them. I wanted to run as hard as I could every weekend. And my goal was to break 4 hours, which is basically a 9-minute mile in every one of these marathons. So up into the 26th marathon, I had done so. In fact, I was getting very fast as the year was going on, contrary to what I thought was even possible. But the problem was, with the 26th weekend of the year, there was only one marathon in North America that I could get to. And it was in Leadville, Colorado. For those of you who don't know, I heard some hmms. Leadville is a very high city. It sits at 10,000 feet above sea level. The marathon starts there and goes up. There's 13,000 feet of up and down in this race that crests at over 13,000 feet at the Mosquito Pass. I looked at the finish results from the previous year. The only guy who broke 4 hours, not 3 hours, but 4 hours, was the guy who won the race. And he lives in Leadville, which I think is cheating, okay? I later learned that he is one of America's greatest ultra runners, guys who run 50 and 100 miles, and he was the only guy who broke 4 hours, okay? I'm going to kill the suspense. I didn't break 4 hours. I didn't break 5 hours. I ran 5 hours and 17 minutes. I also finished in the top 50. That's how hard this race was. But when I finished it, I was like, this should be the hardest thing that I do all year. And to some extent, it was, because it was kind of a symbolic thing. It was the 26th marathon. It was the midpoint of the race, of the year. It was kind of like the midpoint of everything when I got to the top of that Mosquito Pass, came down the other side. I said, you know what? This could be just, I might be able to complete this. Which takes me to the second to the last weekend of the year. Looking throughout the whole year, deciding to do what I did, try to run as fast as I could, I also learned a lot about what makes a marathon a marathon. A marathon isn't just 26.2 miles. It's actually running against competition, against other people on the same day, on the same course, everyone else is out there running. That's what makes it a marathon. Just running 26.2 miles doesn't really count as a marathon, which was a problem. Because the 51st weekend of the year, there were no marathons in North America. There were no marathons on the planet. It makes sense. It's the Christmas weekend. I was like, okay. Well, then I was like, well, that's a little myopic day. Not everyone's Christian. There's like 5 billion people who aren't. So where's the great Jewish marathon? You know, I looked in Israel. I literally looked in Israel. I was like, there's got to be one. They serve Chinese food at the aid stations, you know, stuff like that. But there wasn't. So I said, you know what? If there isn't one out there, I'm going to have to make one. So I became a race director on top of everything else that year. Started the first annual Drake Well Marathon in my hometown of Titusville, named after that oil well that I mentioned to you earlier, Drake's Well. It was a very personalized race. The aid station boxes for every single runner were personalized to whatever they wanted in them. You were catered to like you're an elite runner. These aid station boxes were put out for the runners so they could get whatever they wanted at any time. The race was only limited to 25. It was limited to 25 people because the race medals were hand-carved replicas of Drake's Well that my father carved for every runner. We then took these medals down to a local jeweler who put a plaque on the front of them and then engraved each runner's name on them. So when you finished, you got this personalized hand-carved medal from my dad. That was one of the reasons why we kept the race to 25 people. I didn't want my dad to turn into a sweatshop, basically. Another reason was the logistics. I wanted this to be a literal race. Well, northwestern Pennsylvania in the winter is kind of what we have outside right now. Cold, blustery, snowy. I knew it was going to be difficult to have a literal, actual marathon course. So I figured out a way around that. Those aid station boxes, you're probably wondering how we got them to the runners. It was pretty easy, actually. They were in lane 7. The Drake Well Marathon was 105 and a half laps around my high school track. Let that sink in. Sounds awful. Most runners think, I can't even imagine how bad that would be to run around a loop 105 and a half times. The funny thing is, it was one of the most enjoyable races I've ever run. There were no surprises. You know, there was no hill that popped up at mile 21. With your personal aid station on this side and my uncle manning a water station on this side, it had 211 aid stations. You went 200 meters without liquid. I think anyone can go that long. The guy who finished dead last said it was his most favorite marathon ever. And I was like, really? Ever? He's like, yeah. I was always only like 400 meters behind the guy winning the race. And I felt like I could catch him. I want to break it to him. He was like 30 laps behind the guy, so I just let him go with that. The whole race was run by me, my mom, my aunt, and my uncle. And there's a pretty funny picture of me running the race, yelling at my mom to move a table because it was out of the way in the middle of the race, you know. Next weekend, I finished the entire year in Missouri, small race in Springfield. And it was very low fanfare, and I was really happy about that because it was a personalized goal, even though I was trying to make it private. And finished the race, I walked back to my hotel, and I had a phone call waiting for me from BBC in London. They had heard about what I was doing and wanted to talk to me. So I get back, haven't showered, in my crusty, ugly running shirt, sweat pouring down, salt all over my face. And I take this phone call and talk to the guy, pleasant enough English chap. And we talk for a little while, and then he finally says at the end of the conversation, he's like, so, you know, what's next? I was like, are you kidding me? Like, I haven't even showered from the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, and you're already asking me what's next. And that conversation kind of shaped my life for the next 6 or 7 years. I realized that we kind of live in a world of what's next, and we don't really focus on what is going on in our lives right now. And I told him, I kind of said something like that to that effect to the gentleman, and I said, I have no idea. I said, I'm going to see where life takes me, but right now I'm just going to savor this for a moment. And it reminds me of, I was running a marathon with a guy one time, and we were running neck and neck, and we just, as runners are wont to do, started carrying on a conversation in the middle of the marathon, and asked him how he was feeling. He's like, I'm not having a good day. I'm looking forward to this other marathon I have next weekend. And he starts talking about this marathon next weekend. And I was like, dude, you're in a marathon. Like, focus on this one first. And he's like, yeah, that's a really good point, you know? And he's like, yeah, I should just focus on this one. I finished the race and I talked to him afterwards. He's like, I really appreciate that conversation because, like, I often am looking too far ahead. Now, granted, I say that. I've always got plans, but I always like to stay grounded and think about the present. The reason I'm even here today is a very serendipitous thing. One of those what's next that I did was a couple of years ago. It was a long race that I did. I'll explain to you in a second. But why I'm here was I had finished running a marathon and was sitting in the tarmac with another gentleman who had the same marathon bag that I did. So we knew we just finished the same race. And we struck up a conversation, and he said, how'd it go today? I said, this marathon was a training run. I've got a much longer run coming up in a couple of weeks. And he says, what could that possibly be? And I told him, and he kind of looked kind of confused and didn't say much. And then a couple of days later, I got an email from a gentleman, and he said, we met on the plane. He's like, I got a question for you. He's like, how do you feel about beef, is all he said. And I was like, seemed a little bit of a question, strange question. I said, I got three words for you. I love steak. And he's like, we need to talk. I'll get back in touch with you. This long event that I was doing was a 202-mile relay. Teams of 12 usually run this relay, and you run about 15 to 18 miles total over the course of a day and a half. You break it up over three legs. So you run 5 or 6 miles, then your 11 teammates run, and then you repeat that two more times. Well, I said I'm always bad at handoffs, so I decided to run the 202 miles by myself. So I ran from Gettysburg, Pennsylvania to Washington, D.C. in 202 miles in 50 hours. During the middle of that run, we were actually taping it for posterity, and someone said, you know, what do you want right now? Do you want a power bar? You want a goo? What are you hoping for? I'm sitting there, and my cheeks are swollen, and I'm all exhausted, and I was like, I want a steak. And that got back to the gentleman I mentioned. His name's Darren Williams. He's the executive director of marketing for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Well, he'd taken that off his email. He didn't put that on the email, what he had done. And he found out what I was doing. He says, we need someone out there advocating for beef who does the things that you do. He says, because you always hear about carb loading and all these sort of things for athletics. And they don't realize that it's protein that really powers them. He's like, I've been doing some research on you, and I found that's what you talk about with people all the time, is their need to eat lean beef when they're out there. And over the next 3 years, we've been working together in multiple capacities to get out there and get this message out to people about the power of protein, as we like to say. One of our favorite pictures that Darren took at a race was me and another gentleman. It was a 15K in Utica, New York. Me wearing a Team Beef shirt and a rather sickly looking gentleman next to me with a Go Vegan shirt on. The caption Darren put under that said, one of these guys ran 5 minutes faster than the other, and he's the one wearing the beef shirt. Obviously, there's a lot more that goes into athletics than just what you eat. But all the time I'm asked by people, what do you eat? And they always tell me, how do you stay uninjured? And how do you do the things you do? I've always said it's easy to tell you when things go wrong what happened. If you break your ankle, it's because you fell off the stairs. If, you know, you get sick, it's probably because you were around the kids that had the cold. If things don't happen, it's kind of hard to pinpoint what it is that you do. But without a doubt, what I've been able to do, what I've found out about myself, is a lot of people might not be able to do what I can do. But what I think that a major part of the reasons why I'm able to do the things that I do is because my diet is high in lean beef. It's one of the things that I eat constantly. And I hear people all the time say, well, you know, I had a I had a steak before my race, and it didn't really help me that much. And I was like, well, that's fine. What did you eat the previous 6 months before that? You can't eat crap the entire time and then decide that steak's going to somehow make the entire thing better the night before. You know, and then especially when they say, well, it was like an 18-ouncer that I had, too. I was like, well, yeah, pound and a half might hurt your belly, you know. I don't care what that is. It was funny is because we were working with the Ohio Beef Council a couple of years ago in a marathon, and I was passing out some beef jerky, and I'm kind of a straightforward guy, as you might have gathered. And a gentleman came up to me, and he's like, can I have some? And I said, oh, are you a beef fan? And he kind of points to his Rotown belly, and he says, doesn't it look like it? I was like, no, it looks like you like crap, you know? And the entire beef council was like, oh, God, you know, like, killing our constituents. And the guy paused for a second, and he's like, yeah, you're right. He's like, I do. This is probably beer. He's like, it's not beef that's making me heavy. It's the fries that I'm eating, the fried chicken, and all these things. And it was funny is because I was like, wow, here's a guy who's even an advocate of beef, thinking that beef isn't good for him. And I was like, there's still so much work that needs to be done. So I knew that I had to get out there and continue to do this. And so last year, I moved to Portland, Oregon, and decided I wanted to do one big, very long run before I started doing some other events. So we took to the Oregon coast. I ran from the border of California all the way up Oregon to the border of Washington. 350 miles I ran in 7 days. 50 miles a day we ran. I say we, that's the royal we. It was me. It was just me. When we, along the way, we stopped at schools to talk to kids about eating right, making the right decisions in life, and exercising. And at all these schools, it was amazing to me how many people were surprised that beef was good for them. And so I was like, wow, there is a lot of work to be done. There is a lot of rhetoric that needs to get out there to combat the negative imagery, the unbelievable ignorance that is out there about people who think that they, even amongst the athletes. But another thing I found was this, I call it the silent majority. There are so many athletes out there that are beef eaters, and they just kind of like, you know, let the vegans talk, basically. They don't care. They know what works for them, and they go about it. So I've kind of see myself as the Pied Piper of the beef industry amongst the athletes to get them to go out there and talk to people about how this really fuels their body. And so while I continue to go out there and do new things, this past, just 2 months ago, I ran from a small town in Wisconsin called Dane to Davenport, Iowa, an event that we called Dane to Davenport. And I ran 165 miles in 3 days and then ran the Quad Cities Marathon the next day. And again, basically, we stopped at schools, we stopped at corporations to tell people about the positive changes they can make in their life when they make the right decisions. And one of those right decisions is a healthy diet. And so if I give anything to you today, it's not look how wonderful I am, look at all the great things I've done. It's more or less look what I came from and the things that I didn't think were possible. And I was able to go out there and do. And the healthy attitude that I've been able to gain from running has really served me well. My father passed away last year from complications of Alzheimer's. And people say, well, with a father who was crippled, did that always make you want to go out there and give your best? And I said, you know what? That was the only thing I knew about my father. I never saw him without walking ability. So it wasn't like it necessarily inspired me, maybe subconsciously, but not like right in my face. But it did give me an idea, and I wrote an article called You Get To, because I talked to some friends, and you know, every one of us who's done any sort of athletics slips out the phrase, oh, I have to go for a 4-miler today, or I have to do some sit-ups, or I have to do this, or I have to do that. And I said, you know, you don't really have to. You get to. You're given the ability to do that. Think about all the people that would love to go for a run if they could, you know? And I talk about that not just in athletics, but in everyday life. All the things that we actually get to do that we don't. And so I hope that if my message, you know, resonates with you, it's not, again, not that I think that I'm special in what I've done. While I'm proud of what I've done, I don't, you know, I know where I stand in the running world. And I know where I stand in the world. I'm very, very aware of my stance. But I know that if I hadn't gone out there and tried to do the impossible, it probably would have never happened. I would have never been able to go out there and find out what it is that I do. I would never have this platform to be able to get up here and speak to people and hopefully inspire them to go chase their own impossible. So as I continue to go on and you know challenge people across the country, I hope that they realize that it is amazing what you can do when you just ignore the impossible. Thank you so much, everybody.